This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Overton Window by Glenn Beck, with contributions from Kevin Balfe, Emily Bessler, and Jack Henderson. Read by James Daniels, with an author note and afterword read by the author.
Dedication. Faith. To David Barton, a man who knows the answers were left everywhere in plain sight by our founders. Hope. To Marcus Luttrell, a man who's shown us all what it really takes to never quit. Charity. To John Huntsman Sr., the man I hope to be someday. John, you're a giant in a world that seems increasingly small. Never give up. Never give in. A note from the author. I've been a fan of thrillers for many years. While nonfiction books aim to enlighten, the goal of most thrillers is just to entertain. But there is a category of novels that do both. Faction. Completely fictional books with plots rooted in fact. And that is the category I strive for with The Overton Window. As you become immersed in the story, certain scenes and characters will likely feel familiar to you. That is intentional, as this story takes place in a time in American history very much like the one we find ourselves living in now. But while many of the facts embedded in the plot are true, the scenarios I create as a result of those facts, along with the way things are tied together and the conclusions that are drawn, are entirely fictional. Let's all hope they stay that way. I know this book will be controversial. Anything that causes people to think usually is. In this case, I hope that you're forced to not only think, but also to research, read history, and ask questions outside of your comfort zone. It will ultimately be up to each of us to search out our own truths. While this may go without saying even once, I feel the need to say it again. This is a work of fiction. As such, some of the characters in this audiobook express opinions that I not only disagree with, but I vehemently oppose. I included them in the story because these views, like them or not, are part of the current American dialogue. Ignoring them or pretending that radical ideas don't exist in society does all of us a great disservice. Silencing voices or opinions only pushes them to the shadows and darkness, where they can fester and grow even stronger. You may also notice that the words Republican or Democrat rarely appear in this audiobook, and when they do, it's in an equally unflattering light. We also never meet the President of the United States or learn what party he or she is affiliated with. Those were conscious decisions, and it reflects the fact that what is happening in our country is not about a political party or a particular person. It's about a course of destruction that we have been pursuing at various speeds for the last century. Every day that we scream, "Where were you 4 years ago?" or "It's your party's fault and not mine," or "I didn't vote for him," is a day that we move closer to the end of America, or at least the America our founders envisioned. As I record this introduction, weeks before the audiobook will even go on sale, I already know that my critics will be fierce and unforgiving. They will accuse me of being every kind of conspiracy theorist they can invent, and they will base it all on the plot of a novel that they likely never even read. Fortunately, none of this is about me. It never has been. I've been called every hateful thing there is to call someone, and I can handle it. But when all is said and done, and people look back at this time in the history of our great country, there is only one thing I hope that everyone, critics and fans alike, call me: wrong. Enjoy the audiobook. I hope that it cost you as much sleep listening to it as it cost me creating it.
Freedom had been hunted round the globe. Reason was considered as rebellion.
and the slavery of fear had made men afraid to think. But such is the irresistible nature of truth that all it asks and all it wants is the liberty of appearing. Thomas Paine, The Rights of Man, 1791. Prologue. Eli Churchill was a talker. Once he got rolling, it was unusual for him to stop and listen, but now a distant noise had him concerned.
"Hold on," he whispered.
He cradled the payphone receiver against his shoulder, glanced down the narrow, rutted Mojave dirt road he'd traveled to get here, and then up the long, dark way in the other direction. In this much quiet, your ears could play tricks on you. He could have sworn that there'd been a sound out of place, like the snap of a stalk of dried grass underfoot, even though no other human being had any business being within 20 miles of where he stood, but he couldn't be sure. The moon was bright, and his eyes were well adjusted to the darkness. He didn't see anyone, but with the kind of guys Eli was worried about, you really never do. When he put the phone back to his ear, an automated message was playing. The phone company wanted another payment to allow the call to continue. He worked his last 6 quarters from their torn paper roll and dropped them one by one into the coin slot. He had just 3 minutes left. In a way, it was ironic. After years of planning, he'd brought all the evidence he needed to back up his story, but not nearly enough change to buy the time to tell it.
"Are you still there, Beverly?"
"Yes." The signal on the phone was weak, and the woman on the other end sounded tired and impatient. "With all due respect, Mr. Churchill, I need for you to get to the point."
"I will, I will. Now, where was I?"
As he riffled through his pile of photocopies, a couple of the loose papers got caught up in a gust and went floating off into the night.
"You were talking about the money?"
"Yes, good. Okay. $2.3 trillion is what we're talking about. Do you know how much that is? From sea level, that's a stack of $1,000 bills that would reach to outer space and back with 30 miles to spare. That's how much Don Rumsfeld told the nation was unaccounted for in late summer of 2001. Don't you see? $2.3 trillion is 3 times the amount of all the U.S. hard currency in circulation. You can't misplace that much money. That's not an accounting error. That's organized crime."
"Mr. Churchill, you said in your message that you had something to tell me that I hadn't heard before."
"I know where they spent that money, or at least some of it."
A brief rush of static came and went on the line.
"Go on."
"I've seen the place, one of the places where they're getting ready for something, something big, planning it out, you know? I got a job inside in maintenance as a cleanup man. They thought I was just a janitor, but I had the run of the place overnight. I saw what they're planning to do. They're building a structure."
He checked his notes to make sure he was getting it right.
"Not like a building, but like a political and economic and social structure. They've been working on it for a long, long time. Decades. When they collapse the current system, this new one they've put together will be all that's left."
"I would like to meet with you, Mr. Churchill," the woman said. "Where are you right now?"
"I can't tell you on the phone."
"Say that again. You're fading in and out."
The dry desert wind had been steady and cold since it arrived, but he noticed now that it had died down to almost nothing.
"They're changing the books so that in a generation from now, almost nobody will remember what this country used to be. They've got the economy set up to fall like a house of cards whenever they're ready to tap the first one at the foundation. They've got the controlled media all lined up and ready to carry out their PR campaign. And they've got people so indebted and mind-controlled and unprepared, they'll turn to anybody who says he's got the answer."
"Where can I meet with you, Mr. Churchill?"
"We don't have the time. Just listen now. They're going to stage something soon to get it all started. Just like that $2.3 trillion that's missing, there are 11 nuclear weapons unaccounted for in the U.S. arsenal, and I've seen 2 of them.
A glint of brilliant red light on the wall of the booth caught his attention. He turned, as the man behind him had known he would, and let the phone drop from his hand. Eli Churchill had enough time left to begin a quiet prayer, but not enough to end it. His final appeal was interrupted by a silenced gunshot, and a .357 semi-jacketed hollow point was the last thing to go through his mind. Part 1. It is the power which dictates, dominates, the materials yield. Men are clay in the hands of the consummate leader. Woodrow Wilson in Leaders of Men. Chapter 1. Most people think about age and experience in terms of years, but it's really only moments that define us. We stay mostly the same and then grow up suddenly at the turning points. His life being pretty sweet just as it was, Noah Gardner had devoted a great deal of effort in his first 20-something years to avoiding such defining moments at all costs. Not that his time had gone entirely wasted. Far from it. For one thing, he'd spent a full decade building what most guys would call an outstanding record of success with the ladies. Good-looking, great job, fine education, puckishly amusing and even clever when he put his mind to it, reasonably fit and trim for an office jockey, Noah had all the bona fide credentials for a killer eHarmony profile. Since freshman year at NYU, he'd rarely spent a weekend night alone. All he'd had to do was keep the bar for an evening's companionship set at only medium high. As he'd rounded the corner of age 27 and stared at the dreaded number 30 right in the face, Noah had begun to realize something about that medium high bar. It takes two to tango. While he'd been aiming low with his standards in the game of love, the women he'd been meeting might all have been doing exactly the same thing. Now, on his 28th birthday, he still wasn't sure what he wanted in a woman, but he knew what he didn't want. Arm candy. He was sick of it. Maybe, just maybe, it was time to consider thinking about getting serious. It was in the midst of these deep ruminations on life and love that the woman of his dreams first caught his eye. There was nothing remotely romantic about the surroundings or the situation. She was standing on tiptoe, reaching up high to pin a red, white, and blue flyer onto a patch of open cork on the company bulletin board, and he was watching, frozen in time between the second and third digits of his afternoon selection at the snack machine. Top psychologists tell us in Maxim magazine that the all-important first impression is set in stone within about 10 seconds. That might not sound like much, but when you count it off, it's a long damn time for a guy to stare uninvited at a female coworker. By the 4-second mark, Noah had made 3 observations. First, she was hot, but it was an aloof and effortless hotness that almost double-dared you to bring it up. Second, she wasn't permanent staff, probably just working as a seasonal temp in the mailroom or another high-turnover department. And third, even in that lowly position, she wasn't going to survive very long at Doyle and Merchant. They say you should dress for the job you want, not the job you have. That's especially true in the public relations business, considering that that's where appearance is reality. Apparently, the job this girl wanted was head greeter at the Grateful Dead Cultural Preservation Society. But that wasn't quite right. She didn't strike him as a wannabe hipster or a retro 60s flower child. It was more than the clothes. It was the whole picture, the way she carried herself, like a genuine free spirit. An appealing vibe, to be sure, but there was really no place for that sort of thing, neither the outfit nor the attitude, in the buttoned-up world of top-shelf New York City PR. At about 5 seconds into his first impression, something else about her struck him, and he completely lost track of time. What struck him was a word, or more precisely, the meaning of a word. Line. More powerful than any other element of design, a line is the living soul of a piece of art. It's the reason a simple logo can be worth tens of millions of dollars to a corporation. It's the thing that makes you believe that a certain car, or a pair of sunglasses, or the cut of a jacket can make you into the person you want to be. The definition he'd received from an artist friend was rendered not in words, but in a picture. Just 7 light strokes of a felt-tip marker on a blank white page, and before his eyes had appeared the purest essence of a woman. There was nothing lewd about it, but it was the sexiest drawing Noah had ever seen in his life. And that is what struck him. There it was, at the bulletin board, that same exquisite line, from the toes of her sandals all the long, lovely way up to her fingertips. Unlikely as it must seem, he knew right then that he was in love. Chapter 2. Can I help you with that? Noah's opener, not one of his smoothest, was punctuated by the thunk of his Tootsie Roll into the metal tray of the candy machine. She paused and glanced across the otherwise deserted break room. It was a cool, dismissive gaze that took him in with a casual down and up. Without looking away, she hooked a nearby footstool with her toe and dragged it close, stepped up onto it, and then went back to pinning her flyer in place high up on the corkboard. The gesture made it clear that if all he could offer was a few extra inches off the floor, she would somehow find a way to live without him. Fortunately, Noah was blessed with a blind spot for rejection. She'd winged him, sure, but he wasn't nearly shot down. He smiled and, even at a distance, imagined he could see just a hint of dry amusement in her profile as well. Something about this woman defied a traditional chick-at-a-glance inventory. Without a doubt, all the goodies were in all the right places, but no mere scale of 1 to 10 was going to do the job this time. It was an entirely new experience for him. Though he'd been in her presence for less than a minute, her soul had locked itself onto his senses, far more than her substance had. She hardly wore any makeup, it seemed. Nothing needed concealment or embellishment. Simple silver jewelry, tight weathered jeans on the threadbare outer limits of the company's casual Friday dress code, everything obviously chosen and worn for no one's approval but her own. A lush abundance of dark auburn hair pulled back in a loose fringe twist and held in place by 2 crisscrossed No. 2 pencils. The style was probably the work of only a few seconds, but it couldn't have been more becoming if she'd spent hours at a salon. A number of unruly strands had escaped confinement in the course of the workday. These liberated chestnut curls framed a handsome face made twice as radiant by the mystery surely waiting just behind those light green eyes. He walked nearer, reading over her flyer as she pressed a final pushpin into its upper corner. It was an amateurish layout job, but someone had taken the time to hand-letter the text in a passable calligraphy. The heading was a pasted-on strip of tattered, scorched parchment that looked like it had been ripped from the original draft of the U.S. Constitution. We the People. If you love your country but fear for its future, join us for an evening of truth that will open your eyes. Guest speakers include Earl Matthew Thomas, 1976 U.S. presidential candidate, libertarian, and best-selling author of Divided We Fall, Joyce McDevitt, New York Regional Community Liaison, Liberty Bells, Major General Francis N. Klein, former INSCOM Commanding General, retired 1984, co-founder of GuardiansOfLiberty.com, Kurt Bilger, Tri-State Coordinator, Sons of the American Revolution, Beverly Emerson, Director Emeritus, Founders Keepers, Danny Bailey, the man behind the YouTube phenomenon Overthrow, with 35 million views and counting. Bring a friend, come lift a glass, and raise your voice for liberty. www.founderskeepers.com. The date, time, and location of the meeting were printed underneath. This event, it's happening tonight? Noah asked. Congratulations, you can read. She was moving some other bulletins and notices, repinning them elsewhere to give her announcement a bit more prominence. Well, maybe you should have posted that last week. People make plans. Actually, she said, finishing her rearrangement, this was just an afterthought. I don't really expect anyone here to be all that interested.
No?
No.
Why not?
She turned, a little taller than eye level from the summit of her step stool. Close up now and face on, she had a forthrightness that was every bit as intriguing as it was disquieting.
Do you really want to know?
Yes, I really want to know.
All you PR people do is lie for a living, she said. The truth is just another story to you.
He felt an automatic impulse to mount a defense, but then swallowed it before he could speak. In a way, she was absolutely right. In fact, what she'd just said was an almost perfect layman's translation of the company's mission statement, all weasel words aside. Seemed like an excellent time to change the subject.
I'm Noah, he said. I know. I sort your mail.
The following details were blithely enumerated, thumb to fingertips, summing him up neatly on the digits of a single hand.
Noah Gardner, 21st floor, northwest corner office, vice president as of last Thursday, and a son of a big shot.
Wow, for a second I wasn't sure where you were going with that last one.
Your dad owns the place, doesn't he?
He owns a lot of it, I guess. Hey, I have to confess something.
I'll bet you do.
You haven't told me your name yet, Noah said, and I've been trying to read it off your name tag, but I'm worried that you'll get the wrong idea about where I'm looking.
Go for it. I'm not shy.
On their way down, his eyes wandered only twice, and only briefly. He caught a glimpse of a small tattoo, finely drawn and not quite hidden by the neckline of her top. All that was visible was an edge of the outstretched wing of a bird, or maybe it was an angel. And a necklace lay against her smooth, pale skin, a little silver cross threaded on a delicate wheat chain. Her ID was clipped low along the V of her pullover sweater, which fit as though it had been lovingly crocheted in place that very morning. The badge itself was a temporary worker's tag, only one notch above a guest pass. She was smiling in the photo, but a real smile, the kind that made you want to do something worthy just so you could see it again.
Molly Ross, he said. She tipped his chin back up with a knuckle. This is fascinating and all, Mr. Gardner, but I need to go and service the postage meter.
Well, just wait a second. Will you be at this meeting tonight?
Yeah, I sure will.
Good, because I'm going to try to make it there myself.
She looked at him evenly. Why?
Why do you think? I'm very patriotic.
Really?
Yes, I am. Very patriotic.
That reminds me of a joke, Molly said. Noah comes home, Noah from the Bible, you know.
He nodded.
So Noah comes home after he finally got all the animals into the ark, and his wife asks him what he's been doing all week. You know what he said to her?
No, tell me.
Molly patted him on the cheek, pulled his face a little closer. He said, Honey, now I heard everything.
She stepped down to the floor, scooted the stool back to where it had been, and headed for the hallway. Don't forget your candy bar, she added over her shoulder. Despite his normally ready wit, the door to the break room had hissed closed and clicked behind her long before a single sparkling comeback came to mind. Chapter 3. Department of Homeland Security. Department of Justice. Classified, TSCCO, ORCON, Constitutionalists, Extremism, the Militia Movement, and the Growing Threat of Domestic Terrorism. Executive Summary. As the administration continues to be tested by economic, social, and political challenges unprecedented in our country's history, the rise of radical, reactionary organizations and the accompanying dangers of patriotic rebellion, virulent hate speech, and homegrown terrorism must now be acknowledged as a major threat to national security. With this clear and present danger in mind, it is our recommendation that contingency plans be developed using data from previous exploratory actions, e.g. Ops Rex 84, and in accordance with HSPD-20/NSPD-51 with the following objectives. 1. Identification. Educate law enforcement and enlist the populace in a program designated to profile, identify, and report individuals and groups engaging in suspect behaviors, protests, advocacy, distribution of inciting literature, and/or evidencing support of issues that are known red flags. Militant anti-abortion or pro-life organizers, Army of God, homeschoolers. Anti-immigration border defenders, NAU alarmists, Minutemen, Tea Parties. Militia organizations, military reenactors, disenfranchised veterans, survivalists. Earth First, Earth Liberation Front, Green Anarchists, Seed Bankers. Tax Resistors, End the Fed Proponents, IRS, WTO, IMF, World Bank Protesters. Anti-Semitic Rhetoric, Bilderberg Group, CFR, Trilateral Commission, New World Order. Third-Party Political Campaigns, Secessionists, State Sovereignty Proponents. Libertarian Party, Constitution Party, Patriot Movement, Gun Rights Activists. 9/11 Truth, Conspiracy Theorists, Holocaust Deniers, Hate Radio, TV, Web, Print. Christian Identity, White Nationalists, American Nazi Party, Free Speech Umbrella. 2. Classification, Isolation, Aggressive Watchlisting. Classify identified individuals and groups based on updated DHS threat level criteria. Aggressively deploy surveillance, law enforcement tactics, e.g. knock and talk, sneak and peek, checkpoints, exigent search and seizure, and other available preventative and punitive measures, / resources, e.g. no-fly / no-buy list, as appropriate to scale. 3. Detention, rendition, interrogation, prosecution. The extra-legal practice of indefinite preventive detention / enhanced interrogation / rendition of non-military enemy combatants has been normalized in the public perception, at least to a serviceable extent. The precedent has been established and remains supported by a neutral to positive portrayal in the mainstream media. However, with U.S. citizens suddenly in the news in the place of Al-Qaeda terrorists, some level of psychological resistance must be anticipated and then diffused when it arises. It is the opinion of the committee that such a reflexive populist reaction would prove to be a major obstacle to progress. In fact, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event on the order of a Pearl Harbor / 9/11 attack, there is a potential that the government's reasonable actions in this critical area may be met with significant public outrage and even active sympathy and misguided support for these treasonous, seditious elements and their hate-based objectives.
I think I've read quite enough.
Arthur Isaiah Gardner closed his copy of the new client's binder, placed it carefully on the conference room table, and then slid it a precise few inches forward to a spot just outside his circle of things that mattered. Noah had grown up with a healthy dread of this gesture, but in more recent years, he had come to appreciate its versatility. As an all-purpose expression of deep fatherly disappointment, it worked just as well for a prep school report card as it did for a disastrously leaked presidential briefing document set to splash on the front page of Sunday's Washington Post. The old man breathed a shallow, weary sigh and stood at his place, looking every bit as elder statesmanly as he did in the portrait that loomed over the main lobby downstairs. That oil painting was the closest that most of D&M's 400-odd employees ever got to their company's patriarch. When he wasn't traveling, he kept to his office, and his office had an elevator all its own.
Actually, Mr. Gardner, I think the team would be well served by reviewing...
Who spoke?
Noah's father hardly ever expressed his anger directly anymore. Not like the olden days. His legendary temper had refined with age, and in the past 10 years it was a rare thing to hear him even raise his voice. The venom was all still there, but it had been distilled and purified to the point that its victims often failed to notice the sting of the lethal injection. "Who spoke?" was uttered with genuine wonder, as though the old man had been addressing a cage full of laboratory rats when suddenly one in the back had raised his little pink paw with a question. The room fell dead silent.
"I did."
It was an older man at the far side of the long table, positioned in the power seat on the client side. Nice suit and a fresh, careful haircut, a touch of a rosy blush now rising in his cheeks.
"Stand up!"
The man leaned back a bit in his chair, grinned sheepishly, and then let it fade away. He glanced around, seeking moral support from the others in his party, but no one met his eyes.
"I didn't mean to interrupt," he said feebly.
Arthur Gardner answered only with a slight upward motion of his open hand, reminding the man that he'd been clearly directed to get up onto his feet. A few long seconds crawled by before he complied.
"To put your busy mind at ease," the old man said, "let me assure you that the trifling problem you brought us today is already put safely to bed. The story in the Post has been spiked. An eager team of computer sleuths is tracking down the source of your leak, and the memorandum itself is now being thoroughly and plausibly denied by its authors and blamed on an overzealous local bureaucracy somewhere in the barren Midwest. Who will be the culprit again, Noah?"
"Illinois National Guard," Noah said.
"There, crisis averted. All neatly handled before 10 a.m. this morning by my son. Noah is a brilliant boy, if I do say so myself, though I'm sure he would agree that he hasn't yet inherited his father's taste for blood. Even so, he's more than a match for such a minor predicament."
In the midst of a sip of coffee, Noah raised his cup in mock acknowledgement of the faint praise. From the corner of his eye, he saw the standing man over on the client side raise a curt index finger for attention.
"With all due respect, Mr. Gardner, that may very well be, but—"
"Enough!"
With surprising vigor for a man of 74, Arthur Gardner suddenly swept the heavy binder from the table and sent it crashing into the wall. The government man stopped talking, his eyes a little wider, the rest of his face suspended in mid-syllable. Before the released papers finished fluttering to the carpet, a set of interns quietly scurried from the shadows like Wimbledon ball boys to spirit the wreckage away.
"A columnist in the Wall Street Journal once wrote," Noah's father straightened his cuffs from the preceding exertion as he spoke, "that I had more money than God. I can't attest to that. I don't believe in God, and like a growing number of the world's other major economies, I no longer believe in the dollar either. Only two things are sacred to me now. One is my time, and I'll caution all of you not to waste another second of it. The other is my legacy. It had been my wish today to present you with an opportunity to share in that, but these interruptions are making that nearly impossible. Now, if there are no further objections to deviating from your faxed agenda, I would love to continue."
No one said a word, and he nodded.
"Very well, then. In my review of that unfortunate document, along with your wider state of affairs, I was reminded of two significant events in my life. The first occurred in early 1989 when a coalition of businessmen came to me with a challenge. Their predecessors had sweated out a tidy little $100 million market over the preceding century or so, and these men were happy with the success they'd inherited, but they wanted a tiny bit more. Maybe just 3 to 5% domestic expansion on an annual basis. So they came to me, hats in hands, and asked if I thought such a heady level of growth might somehow be within their reach. And they brought a binder with them, much like yours, full of their fears and worries and their modest little hopes and dreams."
He turned to directly address the other man still standing across the room.
"Mr. Purcell, isn't it? A very slowly rising star, I understand, in our mighty Department of Homeland Security."
A tight little nod, nothing more.
"You were so eager to guide me along earlier. A virgin whiteboard awaits there along the wall, freshly erased, with a new set of colorful markers all at your disposal. I believe we can even muster a laser pointer to help you direct our rapt attention around your fascinating illustrations. So, would you like to lead this meeting now, or will you indulge me to continue?"
A muscle tensed in Purcell's jaw, but he didn't speak. After a moment, he moved to return to his chair, but was stopped by the slightest tick of the old man's hand. It was the sort of unspoken cue that a dog trainer might give to a spirited bitch on her first session off the choke chain.
"Stay another moment, Mr. Purcell. Help me. Ask me
what it was that these men were selling, and I'll show you the path to a whole new world in which everything you want is laid out before you, ripe for the bountiful harvest.
The old man walked around to the other side of the table until the two were nearly toe-to-toe. He nodded, encouraging.
Go ahead. Ask me.
When Purcell finally spoke, his voice was weak and low.
What was it?
Arthur Gardner let a smile touch the corners of his eyes.
Oh, nothing of any value.
Only water. The old man put his hand on Purcell's shoulder, gripped it warmly, and then motioned for the bewildered man to resume his seat, which he did.
Forgive me, everyone. Our colleague, Mr. Purcell, has graciously assisted me in a demonstration, the point of which we will return to shortly.
Projection screens began to hum down from the ceiling, gradually covering the paneled walls of the wide, round room. As the screens clicked to their stops in unison, the lights dimmed to half-brightness. All that remained was a circle of soft illumination that dutifully followed Arthur Gardner as he made his way back to his place.
I'll tell you all what I told those bottled water men 20 years ago in this very room. If that binder is the limit of your ambitions, then you've come to the wrong place. Both sides of Madison Avenue are lined with hucksters and ad men, the most backward of which can deliver such a minor achievement for an insignificant fee. Go in peace, if that's all you want. But they stayed, as I hope you will, and I led them to where they stand today, with their goals not only realized, or doubled, or quadrupled, but in fact multiplied 1,000-fold. And I can do the same for yours.
A bookish younger woman in the client party hesitantly raised her hand just a bit above the edge of the table as though volunteering for a solo frontal assault on the guns of Navarone. She spoke, but only after a nod of permission from the man at the podium.
"I'm not sure we understand what you mean, Mr. Gardner," she said. "Our goals?"
"Your goals, yes, your future. The future of the government you serve. Which is to say, the future of this country, and the urgency to act on her behalf. And that brings us to my second story, which, strangely enough, continues our watery theme. A while ago I was vacationing abroad in Sri Lanka. What year was it now? Oh, yes, 2004, just after Christmas. A servant girl came to me and woke me from the most wonderful dream. She was breathless, the poor young thing, and told me an urgent message had arrived. Word of an earthquake near Sumatra, and that we needed to leave as soon as possible. Well, I had my breakfast brought in as my things were packed and an aircraft was chartered, and we all dressed for travel and then went up to the roof to await our departure. A wave was coming, you see. This earthquake had released the energy of 500 million atomic bombs under the ocean, and a tsunami was spreading out from the epicenter at 500 miles per hour in all directions.
He took a moment to sample his tea, and then set the cup back carefully onto its saucer.
The helicopter soon arrived, and our party began to board. It was such a beautiful morning. Everything seemed as though all was right with the world, and by every appearance all the people down on the beach were completely unaware of what was coming. I wanted to stay, and so we stayed. There were teenagers surfing, families walking their dogs along the sand, or boating, or flying kites. Children were searching for shells with their buckets and shovels. I couldn't look away. It was fascinating to me. The people down there either didn't know or didn't understand that something unthinkable was on its way to destroy them. From the roof I watched the waters slowly pull back from the beach. They all watched as well. It must have been an illusion, but it seemed the sea receded halfway out to the horizon. For every one of those people who turned and ran for higher ground, there were hundreds who stayed, mesmerized as their impending doom gathered strength. I was later told that there had been some form of warning system in place, but it had failed, or that those in charge of the public safety had become so complacent that the red phones and radio alerts went unheard and unanswered. But I'll tell you what I believe.
I believe those people stayed because they thought the fragile things they'd built would last forever. They looked at the breakwater walls and they trusted them. Nothing could breach those walls because nothing ever had before. But when the seas came in, it wasn't in the form of a wave at all. It was an uprising of nature herself, steady and swelling and ruthless and patient, completely oblivious to the frail constructions of mankind. And it was all swept away. My holiday was cut short, and 250,000 people in the region lost their lives. The old man looked to each of the attendees, one by one. Bear Stearns, a cornerstone firm of Wall Street founded when my father was a young man, a company whose stock had quite recently been selling at $160 a share, was bailed out by the Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan at $2 per share. That was the beginning, my friends. That was your earthquake under the sea. As I reviewed your situation this morning, it occurred to me, you're just like those people down on the beach in Kalutara, aren't you? You're watching a world-changing disaster on the rise, and yet for some odd reason you seem to be fretting about how the American people would feel if they were to read of your perfectly justified panic in their morning newspaper. That isn't your problem at all, of course. It's not what they might think of you that should be keeping you up at night. It's what they might very well do to you and to your superiors in the aftermath of the global catastrophe that's just around the corner. Look at you. You're stacking sandbags when your entire coastline is about to change forever. All the while, the crimes you're so worried that people will discover are still in progress. We are in the midst of what will become the most devastating financial calamity in the history of Western civilization. And just this week, please do correct me if my figures are wrong, the Congress and the administration have committed to funnel almost $8 trillion to the very institutions that engineered the crisis. And in your infinite wisdom, you have openly placed their cronies and henchmen in charge of the oversight of this so-called economic stimulus. It's a heist, an inside job. It's been done before, of course. Social Security was the boldest Ponzi scheme in history until now. But all the bills for all those years are finally coming due, and there is not enough money in the world to pay them. A ring of digital projectors near the ceiling awoke out of standby, and the wraparound screens encircling the room came alight with an unbroken panorama of changing, flowing imagery. Charts and graphs, spreadsheets and Venn diagrams, timelines and flowcharts and nomograms, none displayed long enough to absorb, except as a blurry continuum of research and market intelligence behind the old man's words. Over the last century, you've saddled your hapless citizens with $100,000 billion in unsecured debt, money they'll be paying back for 50 generations, if there are still any jobs to be had by then. Meanwhile, you're up to your necks in misguided, escalating wars on two unforgiving fronts with no sign of the end. That's trillions more in unpayable IOUs. Banks are failing across the country. More banks have failed so far this year than in the whole of the last decade. Your debt-fueled economy is entering a spiraling freefall, yet your first reaction was to ignore the needs of the voting public and reward the perpetrators themselves. While foreclosures of your citizens' homes are breaking all records, and unemployment is exploding in every state, you've been busy dodging audits and nationalizing the mountainous gambling losses of the Wall Street elite. For heaven's sake, you nationalized General Motors just to get your union friends off the hook. As you know, those union pensions you just took over are severely underfunded, adding another $17 billion to your tab. $17 billion, I might add, that you don't have.
Arthur Gardner's silvery voice had been gathering strength until it filled the room to the rafters, point upon point with the swelling command and cadence of a tent revival preacher calling down the rapture.
"Just to stay afloat, the government is borrowing $5 billion every day at ever-rising interest rates from our fair-weather friends in Asia. But that will all come to an end as they see the waters receding from the beach. Sooner or later, the truth will be undeniable, that these massive debts can never be repaid, and there will be a panic, a worldwide run against the dollar, and through your actions you've ensured that the results will be fatal and irreversible. It's not only happening here, it's everywhere. Carol Quigley laid open the plan in Tragedy and Hope. The only hope to avoid the tragedy of war was to bind together the economies of the world to foster global stability and peace. And that was done, but with unintended if predictable consequences. Instead of helping each other, these international bankers have all used their power for short-term gains, running up unimaginable debts on the backs of the public. We're all shackled together at the wrists and ankles as the ship goes down, and once it begins, this mutually assured destruction will come on us not over months, but overnight. A depression that makes the hell of the 1930s look like heaven on earth will sweep across this country in a tidal wave of ruin, the scale of which has never been imagined. And when that happens, who do you think the masses will come for? Here's a little hint. The people who will be held responsible are sitting around this table.
The room fell silent. The humming of the projectors was the only discernible sound.
Yes, they will come for you. All of you. You built this system. You told them everything would be fine. It is your lies they will remember when they realize that their money is as worthless as the promises you made them. It is your deceit they will recall when they realize that the future of their children has vanished. And trust me when I tell you, it is your faces they will picture when they realize that 40-hour weeks at minimum wage have replaced their retirements. How do I know all of this? Simple. When things go wrong, there must always be someone to blame. A villain, if you will. As they say in your neck of the woods, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. If you walk out of here today with the same arrogance you came in with, then you, my friends, will all soon be the special of the day. He paused to take them in again. A half-circle of understandably pale, stricken faces lit only by the cold proofs of impending doom projected on the screens around them. "But all is not lost," the old man said. His features softened with the tiniest hint of a knowing smile.
"Tell us what we need to do."
It was the woman who'd spoken up earlier. Judging by the breathy reverence in her voice, she'd already entered the early stages of baptism into the cult of Arthur Gardner. He stepped to a neat stack of identical folders at the near corner of the table and took the top copy in his hands.
"Your answer is in here," he said. "I am a strategist and a man of some modest renown in that sense, though in this case I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. Woodrow Wilson, Julian Huxley, Walter Lippmann, Cloward and Piven, Bernays and Ivy, Saul Alinsky. The list is long. All I've done here," he held up the folder, "is to crystallize the vision of those who've come before me, those who dreamed of a new and sustainable progressive nationalism, but never saw their dreams fully realized. Because we must, we will, finally complete what they envisioned. A new framework that will survive when the decaying remains of the failed United States have been washed away in the coming storm. Within this framework, the nation will reemerge from the rubble, reborn to finally take its rightful, humble place within the world community. And you, he said, looking around the table, all of you will be there to lead it.
A hand went up on the far side, a question from the senior member of the party, who'd so far only listened in silence.
Mr. Gardner, the man said, what about the public? What about them? The public has lost their courage to believe. They've given up their ability to think. They can no longer even form opinions. They absorb their opinions, sitting slack-jawed in front of their televisions. Their thoughts are manufactured by people like me. What about the public? 20 years ago in this room I showed a small group of short-sighted businessmen how to sell the public the most abundant substance on the face of the earth at 10 times the price of premium gasoline. The very same water that flows from their own kitchen faucets for 1/10 of a penny per gallon. That would seem unbelievable. It defies all logic and reason. Your grandparents would have called it larceny, fraud, or wanton thievery. And rightly so, I might add. But that experience proved one thing to me. There's a double-edged sword by which the public can be sold anything, from a $3 bottle of tap water to a full-scale war. The screens winked out at once, and left behind were 3 tall words in black on white, dominating the room from floor to ceiling. Hope and fear. Do you see? If the people are simply swindled, there's always a chance they might one day awaken and rebel against the crime. But we don't change their minds. We change the truth. Most people simply want to be left alone. They'll go along with anything as long as we maintain their illusions of freedom and the American way. We leverage their hopes and feed their fears. And once they believe, they're ours forever. After that, they can be taken by the scruff of the neck and shown the indisputable scientific proof. With their own eyes, they can read the label that says, "Contents drawn from a municipal water supply," and they will only nod their sleepy heads and walk past the faucet to the vending machine. That's when you know that anything is possible.
You!
He pointed to Mr. Purcell at the far end of the table, who flinched as though he'd just been goosed by a cattle prod.
You entered this room thinking of me as a hired hand, believing you were master of these proceedings, and since you pay my salary by all rights, you should have been correct.
Why then did you allow me, your humble employee, to overpower you, to control you, to humiliate you in front of your peers and subordinates? Why? When it became clear that not even a stammering answer was forthcoming, the old man continued.
Indoctrination. I made you afraid, Mr. Purcell, and in your fear you accepted my truth, my power, and you abandoned your own. The public will do the same. Leave them to me. The misguided resistance that still exists will be put down in one swift blow. There'll be no revolution, only a brief, if somewhat shocking, leap forward in social evolution. We'll restore the natural order of things, and then there will be only peace and acceptance among the masses. He smiled. Before we're done, they'll be lining up to gladly pay a tax on the very air that they breathe.
Arthur Gardner walked a few steps closer to the group at the other end of the table.
Each of you was invited here this afternoon at my suggestion. The small but serious problem you brought with you was merely a point of entry, a premise for our introduction today. That leaked document sparked a conversation that I've had with your superiors, and they with theirs, and so on, about a wide-ranging plan of action that has long been in development and now awaits its execution. I told them that now is the time, and ultimately they concurred, with one condition. You, all of you here, are to be put in charge of enforcement. The boots on the ground, if you will. Before this new order of things can be brought forth, it was decided that you must all unanimously agree to protect and defend and rebuild what will remain of this country after its transformation." On the screen behind him, a quotation faded in, finely lettered as though written in the author's original hand. It took a moment, but Noah soon recognized the words from Julius Caesar. "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures." The old man watched them as they read, and then he spoke again. "Shakespeare wrote of a time of great decision, and, ladies and gentlemen, that time has come. We stand at a crossroads. The civilized world stands at a crossroads. Down one path, all men are created equal, equal in poverty, equal in ignorance, equal in misery. Down the other is the realization of the brightest hopes of mankind. But not for all men. That was a brief experiment, tried and failed. Abundance, peace, prosperity, survival itself, these coveted things are reserved for the fittest, the deserving, the most courageous of us, the wisest, the visionaries." The room was still again, and he let it stay that way for a while. "Now," Arthur Gardner said, his voice just above a whisper, "while the tide is in our favor, come with me. You can still save yourselves, and in so doing, you can help us build a whole new world upon the ashes of the old."
Chapter 4. Noah stopped in the middle of the main hallway and stood there for a while, his head full of unfinished thoughts and that troubling fogginess you feel only when you've forgotten where you're going and why. That meeting was still going on, but without him. His father had called a break and passed him a note with a list of phone numbers and a few bullet points of instructions, one last errand to perform before he could leave for the weekend. These were apparently VIPs to be invited for the after-hours portion of the presentation, provided the first part had gone as hoped. Evidently, it had. This task he'd been given had started out strange, and then one by one the calls had only gotten stranger. There were no names, only numbers. Each of the calls was answered before the second ring, not by a service, but by a personal assistant. Every one of those phones was professionally attended after business hours on a Friday night, and probably 24 hours a day by the sound of it. That seemed oddly extravagant, but maybe it wasn't so unusual considering the circles in which his father was known to travel. There'd been